This is an interview for the second wave of the Women's Movement Oral History Project. The date is April 22nd, 2019. This is Andrea Lumdier, and today I'm in Irmo, South Carolina with Harriet Hancock. Harriet, would you start just by giving me your date of birth?
My date of birth is 9/25/36.
And where and when were you born?
Columbia, South Carolina, in the old Columbia Hospital, right here in Columbia.
And who were your parents?
My mother was Elizabeth Galloway McCabe and Daniels, and my father was Harry Adam Daniels, and they both go back in history of Columbia to their ancestors to pre-revolution. People didn't move. They bought property and divided it up and just stayed. That's why my history is very easy to trace on both sides of the family.
Right. And you said you would go back to Thomas Taylor, who was one of
the founders. Yes. He was my seventh time great-grandfather, eighth, something like that. And I recently did a couple of years ago, the research for the DAR, because I always thought I would like to belong to that, but didn't know if I had any connections. And yes, and mine was very easy research to do because of the importance of the Civil War, I mean, the Revolutionary War hero is what he was. And so I could find out about him, and I could trace all of the relatives on that through grave stones in Elmwood, Trinity. He is buried up on the corner of Barnwell and Richland Streets. There's a little church there, and there's a little tiny graveyard where Thomas Taylor and his wife and several of his sons, they were a very important family in South Carolina. His sons were governors, and they all fought in, you know, wars of 1812, and just a very rich history. So I was able to trace it, you know, because the families tend to stay here. So that's my mother's side. My father's side, the ancestor on that side that goes back when he bought land in 1874 out in the Lake Catherine area, Kilburn Park, Lake Catherine area. And there's an old graveyard out there called the Kelly Cemetery, one of the oldest family graveyards in the state of South Carolina. And of course, it's full now, but it sits up on a hill overlooking Lake Catherine. And so that's our family cemetery. And we don't know where he's buried there, but we know he's buried there. And the graveyard started when he, I guess, accidentally wounded his sister, or some of the story goes, and she died, and she was the first person to be buried up there on that hill that was his property, and then it turned into a cemetery. Do you know Mark Land by chance?
No.
He's with the Richland County Public Library, and he is a relative of mine. He's done all the family research, and he's come up with a lot of things that let me know about my father's side of the family. Because they developed all the land where, they owned all the land where Brennan School is and all the land down around the lake. And I have an old, a picture of an old deed where he bought the property in 1784. So anyway, it's been easy to do that. And I've been, you know, don't know why none of my other family members ever researched any of this. They didn't know, you know. I don't think they really cared much about it, but I do care. I'm interested in that. So.
Right. And in doing some of the family research, you found a connection with Majeska Monte Simpkins.
Right. My sister, who's passed away years ago, but anyway, she stayed in Columbia while I lived away when my husband was working for RCA in different places and we moved around. But she called me one night. She said, I just came from the interesting lecture, and I met this woman. She was on the panel, whatever. And she said, her name is Majeska Monte Simpkins. And she said, you know, I believe we related to her. And she said, she looks just like our Aunt Rebecca. That would have been our great aunt. And she said, it's amazing, you know, semblance there. And she said, we ought to look into that. And I said, oh, well, that's really interesting. She said, I was so impressed by her. My sister and I have been civil rights activists forever. You know, when we were little kids, we didn't understand all that segregation and the way African Americans were treated, and we would just, you know, we didn't. But so we were very open to finding out if we were related to her, we'd be tickled, you know. But we didn't do anything about it at that time. But then when I started, you know, Becky started doing the book, and I said, okay, I'm going to look back, and I saw a film that Progressive Network had made about Majeska Simpkins, and I thought I'll just research a little further. Started looking at the going through grave, you know, grave find a grave, and actually found out that from my cousin that I was related to Thomas Taylor, but it's through Thomas Taylor's side of the family. One of his descendants married the Monteith, who fathered Majeska's father. Right. And that story's on the back of the page of that book. He was, and a lot of, now that I found this out, I've been in touch with some of the, you know, relatives on that side of the family. But I'm just thrilled to know that we have the connection. So my great-grandmother and Majeska's father were half-brother and sister.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So that's how I found that out. And like I said, I was really thrilled to know that we shared the same bloodline. Because mm-hmm. I admire her so much.
Yeah. She was a great woman.
She really was.
She accomplished so much.
And she didn't take a back seat to anybody. She just had a lot of courage and she was determined. She was not going to take a back seat to anybody. And she was wonderful. And unfortunately, I never got to meet her. My sister met her, but I never got to meet her. But I certainly know a lot about her from what people say. Oh, Majeska said this. And I think one of my famous things that a friend of mine told me that he knew her and that she said people would call her an agitator. And she said, I don't mind that name, agitator. I said, agitator's in a washing machine and it gets the dirt out. So that's what I'm doing. I'm getting the dirt out.
Oh, that's a great saying.
Right. Don't know if it was phrased exactly that way. And I thought, I like that. I really like that. Yeah.
So talk to me about growing up in Colombia and sort of who were your influences in...
You know, I grew up in a family that was, you know, very blue collar. My mother worked at Belk because she, well, she's very smart to begin with. She went to Columbia High School and then she wanted to go to business school, but that was not possible because it was like approaching the Depression. There was no money. So I think when she was about 15 and she was going to Columbia High downtown, she started working at Belk part-time. And that just, because she couldn't go to business school, she stayed in that job and she became a buyer for Belk. And she worked there until she was in her 60s. She never had any other job. So when we were growing up, we had this very pretty mom. There's a picture of her in there. I'll show you in the book if you can see who we're talking about. As we talk about her, I'll show you a picture of her that's in here. Becky did such a good job on this book. It should be in the early part of it. But see, there's some pictures of Thomas Taylor. And yeah, that's my mom.
Oh, yeah.
And that's me and my sister and my brother. And then I had a younger sister who wasn't born at that time. So, but that's my mom. So I was raised by this very attractive woman who dressed because she was in the business world. She was in the retail world. And we always thought she was the prettiest thing. Well, she really was. We were all blondes and she had dark hair. And my mother was the most kindest, generous person. I mean, she would absolutely... probably go to work with, walk to work from where we lived on Anthony Street to downtown Columbia because she didn't have bus fare. But if she had any lunch money, she'd end up giving it to somebody, that some poor person on the street, you know, some blind person or whatever. She was just very generous, and that was that set the tone for us. And my father was the same way. He'd go fishing or hunt, and he'd come back, and he'd take the fish, and he'd clean them, and he'd take them to work the next day to give them to people that, you know, could really use it. So I just saw this kind of generosity all of my life. Every Sunday, we had a maid that worked for us, and she wasn't a maid because she came to clean my mother's house because my mother was lazy. My mother worked. My mother needed child care, so we had a maid. And when she had a stroke and couldn't work anymore, my mother, she took care of. If she got sick, my mother got a doctor for her. Every Sunday, we packed up. Mother cooked enough to take to her and her son and her invalid mother, they were both invalids, to every Sunday take food to them. And we just, that was a Sunday afternoon thing. We packed up the car with food from the day and whatever else she needed. And we went down and visited her on Sunday, every Sunday, after she, you know, had a stroke and couldn't work for us anymore. So I saw this kind of generosity and giving all my life. My house was an open door that we, of course, in the neighborhood where we were raised, this is on property from my father's family, had been divided up, so everybody on the street were cousins all around us. So we went in and out of each other's houses like we, you know, it was just a big family. You know, my cousins, it was like we had a huge family there, and we just were all very close. And I just kind of saw this thing throughout my family all my life, and my sister did too. So we just kind of, it was like a natural way of life for us to kind of just give to people. make life better for somebody else. And I'm not perfect, God, no. But I saw this, and it was just the way people were supposed to do. You're supposed to help each other. And so I saw that growing up. So that was the biggest influence, I think, both my mother and father. And I was so closer to my father, though. And that was because my sister, when she was born, she's 17 months older than I am, she was a premature baby. And, of course, they just, everything was around her. They stayed up at night to watch her sleep. You know, I mean, it was that kind of thing that was. And then, of course, 17 months later, I come along and I'm this very healthy 10-month baby, you know. They didn't want to do anything but eat and be held. And so I think they kind of passed me down to my grandfather and my father to be the caretaker of me. So I became closer to them than I was to my mother and grandmother, who doted on my sister. It wasn't that the love wasn't the same. It was just how you kind of grow closer because, you know, my daddy taught me how to, you know, first thing he gave me, I think, you know, when I said I wanted a BB gun, he bought it for me. You know, it was like I was his little sidekick, and he used to take us fishing. And my sister didn't like to fish. She couldn't stand to put a worm on a hook. And me, I'm like, I can do that. You know, like, so, yeah, I think I was probably a little closer to him and just doing things with him. But I just think I came from a great family. We didn't have a lot of money. I think we had a roof over our heads. And I think my mother worked a lot to give us nice clothes and things that we couldn't have otherwise. But it was a struggle, you know, during that time. Because, like I said, I thought we were rich because we always had enough to eat and had a roof over our head and had nice clothes. And I thought, I didn't know how poor we really were until I got out in the world. And my father was a white-collar worker. He worked at Firestone as a salesman. He did business in selling tires to big commercial enterprises. So, you know, I wasn't raised on a farm. I was raised, you know, in the city. So it was a little different. But anyway, I think I had a great childhood. Of course, we had our ups and downs, and like any family does. And I don't hide anything. In later life, my mom and dad were both heavy drinkers, more or less after they retired, and we had a lot of problems with that. And that kind of broke my heart. My father committed suicide when he was in his 70s, and I think he did that because he was sick. And he kept saying, I don't know why God's leaving me here in this pain, and, you know. Yeah. And I think he suffered some depression in his life. He committed suicide, but that wasn't the first time he ever, you know, never did it, but would, you know, several times think about it and go to the point of locking himself in his work office with a gun, you know, that he was going to do it and being talked out. Right. So he had some depression in his family during that time. But so we had our ups and downs, but I consider, looking around today, that I wouldn't trade my childhood for anything, because we didn't have helicopter parents. You left the house when you got ready. When we lived in an area that we considered very safe, right on the edge of Columbia, where Brennan's school is now. And it was woods then. There was no school, and there were some building going on, but we had the roam of the land. We went out to Bowers Beach and Lake Catherine and Gills Creek and all of those places, and our parents didn't worry about us, and swam in this little place called Bowers Beach, which is a little pond right connected. If you go down Kilburn Road, off to the left when you get to Lake Catherine, there's this little pond that's adjacent to it. So we swam and, you know, did all kind of things. And we were just free to discover things on our own. And I think it's a great childhood.
Yeah. And talk about what you did once you left high school. Did you go into the workforce or to college?
I got married.
You got married.
I took cosmetology in high school because they taught it at Columbia High then. And I was... worked as a cosmetologist for about a year after I got out of school to put my husband through school. He was an engineering student going on the Korean GI Bill. He went in service in 49, and then after the Korean War, he went to Carolina, and we were married. I was in nurses training. I wanted to be a nurse, but at that time, they were so strict on the women in nurses training. I mean, you had such a terrible curfew, and you know, and my husband and I, we wanted to date, and we wanted more freedom, and you couldn't get married when you were in nurses training then. So I just, after I was there for a while, I just quit and got married. And so then I worked and put him through school, and then when he graduated, we moved to New Jersey because he had his first electrical engineering job with RCA in New Jersey. So that's where, you know, my first child was born in Columbia when he was still in school, and her name's Karen. And she's a dentist now. She lives in Maryland. And then we moved to Cocoa Beach, Satellite Beach, Florida, because he was engaged in missile tracking. He went to work for the government. This was in the days when there was the missile and the manned space programs and all of that. You know, that was an exciting time in our lives because it was like, when we moved there, there was no housing. We had to live in a motel. It was like a boom town. Everything's a boom town. Cape Canaveral, missiles, you know, all these big engineering companies coming in. And I think we had to live in a motel for a long time while our house was being built. And it was an exciting time because I can remember that we would go out on the beach at night to watch the night firing of the missiles. And it was exciting. And we would, you know, take a blanket and, you know, some drinks and take the kids and all the night we went down the beach because we could see from where they were firing the missiles much better from the beach angle. So that was an exciting time for us. And my son was born there, my gay son. And then I have a daughter, Jennifer. She lives here. And we moved, when she was 6 months old, we moved to the D.C. area. He got transferred with his government job. So that was kind of my life then.
Yes, and so you're raising kids, and you're in the home mostly.
And I'm young. I didn't work. My husband didn't want me to work because at that time, none of the women that I was associated with in our neighborhoods worked. They took care of kids. And my husband really was adamant about wanting our kids to be cared for by me. He didn't want anybody else raising the kids. He wanted me to raise the kids.
Yeah.
So I didn't work. And I enjoyed not working. I enjoyed it because we had a lot of free time to take the kids to the beach because it was a great place to live and so many things to do. And, you know, we had a boat and we just had a good time. So, yeah, the problem is that my husband became an alcoholic, too, and he died of alcoholism, and we had separated at the time. We moved when my daughter, when Jennifer, my youngest daughter, was 6 months old. That's when we moved to the D.C. area. My marriage was already in trouble, though. It was in trouble because, unfortunately, he was a very jealous, possessive man. He almost tried to take me away from my family by, you know, not wanting me to communicate with them that much, and I wouldn't have any of that. He might do other things to me that he had control over me. That was not one of them. So when he was, you know, had alcoholism, it just kept growing. He was the kind of person that could, he drank all day, but it didn't affect his work. But at night, when you come home and you add more to that, he drank more and he made our lives miserable. So I knew I couldn't live in that. And I tried to talk to him about it, as did the rest of his family members. And he was just of the opinion, because I think they said to him, she's going to leave you. She can't live in this anymore. And he just said, she doesn't have anywhere to go. She didn't, you know, what's she going to do? She can't leave me. In other words, unfortunately, things get so bad you don't really think, you just have to leave. And I came back to South Carolina, and he lived about a year later, hoping that I would come back, and because I'd given it so many chances that it never worked out, that was the last straw. Yeah, and then he passed away a year later. And then I started going to school. I had never been to college before.
So that must have been a kind of scary time for you.
It was, but, you know, what do you do? I was a hairdresser, to put him through school, but I had long given up all of that, and I didn't want to do that anymore anyway. And fortunately, because he had survivor's benefits, I had a pension from the federal government, and the kids had Social Security, you know, because he had both. So we were able to survive once again, you know, scraping by, but managing to do it. That I went to school, my son and I were both students at the University of South Carolina at the same time, and sometimes we'd end up in the same classes. And I would think it was so fun and funny, and he thought it was the worst thing in the world to have your mother in class with you. It was like, oh. And I was like thrilled.
And what did you study?
What did I study?
Yes.
I didn't really declare a major. At that time, I think you could go almost through to the end without declaring a major. And finally, I just looked down and said, what do I have the most credits in? I didn't enjoy math. I just took whatever I could do to get out of there. And sociology seemed to be what I was drawn to, and the liberal arts. And so I got a degree in sociology. And then a friend of mine, who also was in the sociology class, she was a year ahead of me, she started law school, and she was just, her name was Holly Salibi, Holly Atkins now. She's an attorney in Columbia, and we were really good friends. And she said, you should go to law school. And I said, oh, I can't get into law school. She said, I got into law school. You can get into law school. And so she gave me and then I said, but I don't have any money. She said, you can get loans. Everything she said was like, she really, and I began to entertain the idea, and I began to think through it. And I thought, well, I'll just take the test. And I didn't have enough money to buy the tutorials that people take before they take
the LSAT.
Yeah. So she loaned me hers because she was already a year ahead of me. And I studied them, and I took the LSAT. Obviously, I didn't do too badly because I got in. But everything would happen. I would go, that hurdle's gone. What's the next one? And then when I got there, it was like, yeah. And I didn't have much problems, in undergraduate school. Law school was a whole different ball game. It was so much harder. So because I was a member of Phi Beta Kappa and an honor graduate of USC. And then when I got to law school, it's like you fall right into the middle here. Everybody else is here, is smarter than you are, or as smart as you are, or as smart as you think you are. And it was a rude awakening, and it was a struggle. I think it was a struggle for a lot of us. And there were some people that just seemed to be able to do it. But yeah, so, but I was glad I did. I mean, it was really hard. It was like 3 years of my life that I was still handling problems and issues with my own family, still trying to raise my family. I had a daughter still at home who was a real handful. And so it was struggling through law school, scraping by. My family helped me as much as they could, but they didn't, couldn't do a lot. My sister did everything. She said, she bought my clothes. She said, you're going to look like everybody else when you go to law school. I said, look, we don't dress up that much anymore. The guys don't necessarily wear suits and things to class like they did, I think, when they first were going to, law school years ago. So everybody helped me, whatever they could do. Not a lot, but. So they made it possible for me to do that.
And what years were you in law school at USC?
I started in 85 and graduated in 88.
And how many women were in your class?
A lot. Well, a lot. I'll say it was a lot at the time. But now I think it's probably majority women in law school now. I think they probably outnumber the men at USC. All right, there was a time when it did. But the first graduating, in my graduating class, there were two women who were the two top people and graduates in our class. So we had some very smart women. And, I think that was the time when women were beginning to, think that, certainly in my case, I never in the world dreamed that I would go to law school. And if it hadn't been for Holly, kind of encouraging me to do that, because I always had a keen interest in legal issues. I loved the law. I loved to read everything about legal issues, and I was an avid reader. And I thought, I could do this. And I think with the intent of more going into an area of poverty law or, public defender type work, except I don't like criminal. I mean, I did have an internship at the public defender's office. I clerked there. And I realized really quickly that I could never do that, because I felt so sorry for the people I would be representing, because they weren't getting the representation, because we had so many cases. Yeah, I could see so many cases and people pleading out. And I thought, I can't do this. I'd take it home with me and I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. So even though I enjoyed that, I mean, I'm glad that I did that. I did not go into criminal law when I got out of school. But it was a good thing that I did, have that experience as a law clerk, because then I found out that was something I didn't want to do. So when I went into private practice, I just did a little bit of everything. And then you kind of find your niche, and mine happened to be family law and some estate planning and writing wills and things. And that did me very well, because by that time I had already started I'm getting ahead of myself here, to be involved in the LGBT civil rights movement. And I could work through my legal experience to help people because they couldn't get married, know how to protect themselves in relationships by doing wills and healthcare powers of attorney. And so I really had a lot of LGBT clients in my practice, and I felt like I was, you know, a lot of them I represented for no fee, you know, just because I, you know, felt their need and knew that it was something I wanted to do. So I did some pro bono work for mostly in the community, mostly with people with HIV who had lost their jobs and was struggling with the insurance companies. And that was a real challenge because insurance companies were denying out of hand pre-existing disease and all kinds of things. And people that had been productive in their lives, a lot of them had very good jobs, were suddenly without a job, without any insurance, and their lives changed so completely that they were just practically living on the streets. So I did a lot of pro bono work for people with AIDS.
And mostly men, or were women being?
Well, because I was a co-founder of Palmetto AIDS Life Support Services, and that was in the year I started law school. Was the year we founded PAL. So here I am. I'm going to law school struggling, and I'm involved in founding this organization that I became a board member and a volunteer and did a lot of work. No, we had clients from, we had children. We had, I was the, we called them, it was a buddy system. I was a buddy to a baby who was born with AIDS, and to a little boy whose parents, I mean, not whose parents, but whose relatives were so afraid of him spreading, the ignorance was unbelievable, that they wouldn't keep him. And so we had to find ways to take care of this child, you know, and we helped him through the legal issues and everything. In fact, if I recall, I think that Bill Edens, and I think it's in one of my books, pamphlets I prepared for PALS, that he was actually went to court and the family court appointed him, and he was gay, you know, as a guardian for this child, as, you know, to take him in. A foster parent is what I'm trying to say. And so Brett lived with Bill, and then I would take care of Brett, so we kind of worked it out together. And it was a lot of people. It just wasn't, and certainly most of our clients were gay men, but it reached all across every walk of life.
And yeah. What motivated you to start PALS?
Well, I had a gay son, and I was already involved in the movement I started Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays in 1982. My son came out to me 80-81, and immediately I knew just instinctively that nobody in the world chooses to be gay, and he certainly didn't choose to be gay. Knew how hard it was for him to tell me all that. And so I just embraced him completely. And of course, my heart sank and I was anxious, not because he's gay, but because the way the world was going to treat him. And I didn't just be kept out of the mainstream of life and maybe beat up and all kinds of things. So it was scary for me. But never did I reject him. So I started this group of PFLA because I knew that there was a need for parents to be able to understand about their child, because so many people were under the impression that they chose to be gay and that they just wanted their children to get back away from that lifestyle that they were basically persuaded to be that way by some horrible person, and that they could come back to be. They didn't understand that it was not a choice, that it wasn't something that somebody influenced you to be, and they needed education so that until you get beyond that point, you still have this hope that you can change your child, and it's just not going to happen. So I started PFLA because I wanted to help other parents and help gay people to work through that process. And so Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays does that. So when I started that, I didn't, that was in 82. How do you get the word out that you started this organization? First of all, you got to bring your son out of the closet. I mean, why are you doing this? Well, it's because I have a gay child. And everybody knew it couldn't be my girls. So it had to be Greg. And he was out to some, well, I think he was out to some people, but mostly in the LGBT community. And so I had to get his permission to start this organization and to, you know, bring him out of the closet. And so he thought about it when I said, I want to do this, but it's up to you. I'm not pushing you. I just know that there's a need. I know from your own friends when they come over here and we talk and they say, why can't you, my mom, be like you? What did you do? How did you get to be so accepting? And what, you know, they just needed something and the parents needed something. So when I started that organization, that was the reason why. Mostly for parents and family members, but it was really for the gay community too, to help them work through those issues and to know that somebody out there, we're a group of people, we love you. If you want to come down meetings, walk through the door, we hug you. You know, it was very encouraging for them. So I did it because my son and opened my eyes about the real, true, what was going on. You know, I never paid that much attention to it before when he wasn't gay. Why would I? You get involved in things that affect your life directly for the most part. People that have children with certain illnesses, you know, they never paid much attention to it before. Maybe they were sympathetic, but boy, when your child is affected, you really get in there and you want to find out more about it. So I think that was certainly my way of becoming involved in the LGBT community. So I went around to bars to let people know that there was a group called PFLAG. And my son would take me, and my sister would go too. I'd say, I want to go, and I want to pass out some pamphlets, and I want people to know if they have parents that they want to come, here's going to be this meeting, and I'd make a little announcement. So I went around to all the gay bars. That way I became involved in knowing my son's friends and some of the people I met in the gay bars, and I became a real advocate of drag shows. I mean, not an advocate, but a real fan, and met a lot of the performers and drag queens. So I just sort of developed a friendship among the community, and I was trusted. They knew they could trust me. And so that's how I got to know people in the community and to begin the work. And then I went to a PFLAG convention in Denver in 1984. And when I was there, I heard about this disease called, they were calling it GRID at the time, gay-related immune deficiency, later known as HIV/AIDS. But that's what they were calling it. They were calling it gay-related immune deficiency. That was what everybody was calling it at the time. And there was a woman there who had lost a son. Later on, she lost a second son because he became infected too. And I just kept hearing. I really hadn't heard much about this disease. Maybe a smattering, something in the news, but it just wasn't news in Columbia, South Carolina. It was not. And I thought, and they talked about how it spread, and they did not know, you know, there were so many unknowns scientifically about the disease at the time. But it was coming across. It was not just in California and New York in the big cities. It was spreading out to the smaller communities and to the, you know, smaller cities in the South and everywhere. And I thought, this is really going to be horrible. What's going to happen? Because there will be a time that there's going to be people in Columbia, South Carolina, and South Carolina affected by this, and what's going to happen. And at the same time, well, I just wrote a letter to a bunch of hospitals saying, I have this organization called Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. I've learned of this disease. By now, they may have been calling it AIDS. I don't know. But if you have any patients in your hospital who need visitation, who need a friend, you know, we will be glad to visit. And I kind of got with the Metropolitan Community Church, and we got some people to volunteer, and we did. We were called to the upstate to a hospital. I think it was Lancaster. I can't remember. It's in the book. And we visited a man whose family had completely rejected him. I can remember all I could think about when I was going to do something nice for people. I would always bake cookies to take. So I'd bake these chocolate chip cookies with nuts, and I just had this tin, you know, a little gift. And the first thing I was determined to do when I walked in that room was to walk over and touch this person. Touch was very important. People weren't hospital workers weren't touching without gloves and, you know, everything. So we started a visitation with this man, and when I talk about the cookies, the poor fellow didn't have any teeth, so he couldn't eat the cookies. That was what the first thing I thought, oh gosh, what have I done? I got this tin of cookies and he can't even eat them. But that wasn't the important thing. The important thing was that we were there. And we continued to visit. Sometime I couldn't go because I was in law school, but the church people continued to go. And so that was our first experience. And then we started, because other it did come to Columbia. And it there was a young man who came down with it. And the way he was treated in hospitals, people they wouldn't take his food trays in or out. You've heard the stories. They didn't want to come in the room. The help scared to death. Your food trays would stack up in the room, or they would put you. The care was horrible. Not even cleaning your room, it could be filthy. The doctors were great. They would raise the roof. Do I need to?
No, you're good.
Okay. They would raise the roof, but you couldn't get through to the people in the hospital. Some of them were not that intelligent, and they were just running scared. So we had to. We did a lot of intervention with, hospital people. Try to be nice and say, look. But they were afraid they were good. So we went through all that, and he went through all that. And then the church, they pulled away, his church that he went to, from the family and from him entirely. They were not going to, So I think when he, so he kind of became the impetus. His parents, Tony Price, who was a big leader in the LGBT movement. Four of us got together. MJ Wasson, she was a friend of the young man, Buzz Aldrin, Buzz Aldrich, who was infected. And then Keith Pirtle, who was a bar owner, and me. And we went to California Dreaming one night, and we talked about starting this organization, what we're going to name it and what we're going to do. And then we had a meeting at Trinity Church, and so we started Palmetto AIDS Life Support Services. We had a fair number of social workers involved, people that just wanted to help because they realized they could see the handwriting on the wall. And it happened, because when we tried to raise money for PALS, it was such a stigma. The big organizations that normally are so benevolent to charities and things, especially illnesses, they slammed their doors in our face. They did not want to even be associated with the name HIV, AIDS, gay, anything, and they all related to that.
So you saw a big change in the support.
Yes. So they didn't support. And so we had to raise every penny that we had to try to fund our little Palmetto AIDS Life Support Services organization. We didn't have a home. We ran our business out of Bill Eden's apartment up in Cornell Arms for a while, and then we found an office, and then we, so we just moved from place to place, whatever we could afford, and some of the thing. I think when we ended up in this motel that was on Assembly Street, I can't even remember the name of it now, but it was not a real thriving motel. It was kind of going downhill a little bit. We got some office space there, and I think that might have even been donated. So we struggled with everything, but the first money we raised it in gay bars around the state. We had what was called like a palathon or something, and we just every bar competed to raise the most money, and we raised about $10,000 in this one endeavor. And it was at night, and we'd have people in Myrtle Beach working down there, and they'd call in with their total. We'd have people in bars, all of it was in bars. So that was our big fundraiser, and that was where we got the money. There was nobody out there. Right. Churches, in the name of Christianity, they turned their backs. They came around later, but, in the beginning, it was like, we don't even want to talk about this. First of all, it was so much unknown at the time. Well, it wasn't unknown. People just wasn't believing it. We knew that it didn't transmit through the air because it just didn't. You couldn't get it from breathing. We knew that. And how you got it, people would think that you touched somebody, you were going to get it. So we had to fight the stigma. We had to fight the stigma of it being gay men. And mostly, they thought it was a gay man disease. That's why they named it GRID, till they found out it affected a lot of other people. So that was a lot of years that we just struggled and struggled. And I always said we had to have a sense of, there was a lot of laughter going on in that PALS office. And I'll tell you why. We didn't find things to laugh about. We couldn't have stood it. We just couldn't, because every day there was some crisis. There was also problems with the legal system. You know, they did name reporting for people with HIV back then. I mean, you had to put your name in. Other states were doing anonymous by number so that, the you know, your name wouldn't be known. So, because they would say it's name reporting, but it's confidential. How confidential when you get when you're dealing with these agencies where you're, it wasn't confidential. So we'd send people to Georgia to get tested because they didn't have to give a name. We'd send them to North Carolina. So we were in sort of a fight with DHEC and the legal system because they insisted on name reporting, which they had. But we tried to work our way around it by sending people other places so their name wouldn't be in our system, you know.
Right.
So we tried, and we had a lot of really smart people working with us. That's what I can say. We found a way. We found ways to do things with no money. I mean, you know, just really working hard to get, because the demands were so unreal. You lost your job. You lost your insurance. You have no money. You're getting ready to live on the street. What can you do? Who's going to?
Right. And now during all of this, do you consciously realize that you're an organizer and you're leading and you're growing
No.
these groups?
No, I didn't really realize any of it. All I know was when I was in law school and we started PALS, and I, you know, for the first, you know, year, I guess I was on the board always. You know, I said, and a buddy to different people. I wanted to be a part of the volunteer organization that worked directly with the patients. With, you know, and everybody was assigned, you know, everybody had at least, they were buddy to at least one person. And we had a lot of volunteers from, you know, some from the straight community, but mostly from the LGBT community that worked and helped us. And no, I just said, I said, y'all, I'm in law school here and this, I'm overwhelmed with it and I'm just going to have to resign from being on the board and having such an active part in PALS. And they said, okay, and then they came to me and they said, you can't do that, Harriet. You are a straight woman. You're known in the LGBT community. We need you to be the president of this organization. We will help you. We know you're in law school. But, you know, for the sake of the organization, you are the person that needs to be up there knocking on doors. You're a straight woman. You know, you have a good background. You need to be a face of PALS too. And I said, I said, okay. So I did. And gosh, I stayed on the board. I think it was 1991 that I finally decided. And by this time, by 1991, I had already been involved in starting the first Pride March, starting what was called South Carolina Gay and Lesbian Pride Movement, which the first march was in 90. And by 91, PALS was on a sure footing. By then, they had help from the many allies in the LGBT community and in the straight community and in corporations. They were getting grants. And so I felt at that time I could devote my time to maybe I could spend a little time in law school, a little bit more time than I needed to spend. And then work with the movement because I was very interested in people being able to come out and live their lives as who they are and stop being afraid of being outed, to be able to put the picture of their partner on their desk at work, to be able to live their lives as they should and needed to. And that was what I wanted to focus on. So, but I stayed with PALS. I love PALS. To this day, I support PALS. And I think they're doing a great job. And I'm really proud to be a part. There's a picture of Bill Edens in that book. And I was sitting across from him. He was the, he became the executive director. And he died of AIDS in, I'm trying to think, in the early 90s, 93 or 4.
And as a woman doing all of this, have you had any challenges as a woman navigating law school and these organizations?
Yeah. Well, the thing about law school, it wasn't the guys so much that, you know, everybody knew I was involved in work with the LGBT community. And I remember that they, you know, when they started having a Gay Awareness Week at USC or a day where they'd have to, woman who was in law school with me said, I don't know why they, why don't we have a straight person's organization? You know, in other words, And I just sort of, and we went a group of about six people, and I just lit into her. You know, I just said, and why would you think you need that? Are you living in a closet? Would you be fired because somebody knows you're straight and this, and, you know, turn the tables here? And she really just didn't know what to say back to me. And it was very quiet. Everybody in the whole group stopped talking and kind of walked away. And I thought, she apologized to me later for that. And it took her about a whole year before she realized. And she said, I'm so sorry for what I said to you that day. Because it was directly aimed at me. And I think we had just picked up our newspapers, and I think there was something on the front of the Gamecock that talked about, you know, gay awareness or whatever. And that's why she said it. And she said it because I was in the group. And I know she did. And it just... So it was not only just... people in general were kind of, you know, not accepting. I never thought I was... as being a woman is being a detriment. I just never had that experience, except I did feel that when I started practicing law. I always felt the judges, because the male lawyers in the room, they'd walk up and talk to the judge about, you know, before the case started, about fishing and being buddy-buddy and golfing. Women didn't do that. And I resented that. And I think somebody finally called them out on it, and they stopped doing it. Because here you are in a courtroom with your client, and you're over at your table, you're waiting for the proceedings to start, this guy's walking up, and the judge is at the bench, and they're talking about their good old buddy thing. And my client's looking at me like, do you know the judge? You know, I mean, I know what they were feeling. Like, I've lost this already. My lawyer doesn't know that judge. You know, it worked against us. So I saw that in the courtroom. Not all judges were guilty of that, but there were ones who were. So... And I don't think they thought there was anything wrong with it. They just didn't realize how it made a woman feel, you know, because women were not excluded in that golf group or in that. Well, at that time, they couldn't even go to the Palmetto Club.
Right.
Until Jean Toe became Chief Justice, and then that all changed. So I think a lot of times men just were not aware that what they were doing to women and how they were. But those are the kind of things that happened that they just weren't. Didn't think about, but we felt it. I always felt we had to work harder. I always felt like women in law had to just go the extra mile to prove themselves because they were women. I did feel that. But as my work as an activist for the LGBT community, all of them were discriminated against from the get-go. So
right. I felt that. You were an advocate in the face of that advocacy.
And I just, you know, I didn't back away from anything. When somebody would tell a gay joke, I'd say, you know, I resent that. You wouldn't tell a joke about black people anymore. That's not acceptable. But you think you can tell dirty jokes or you can tell ugly jokes or say things about gay people? I'd just say that's not appropriate. Sometimes I'd say I have a gay son and you hurt my feelings. And then what are they going to say, you know? So I was always just kind of, I didn't back away from speaking my mind at all. And so I don't think I fit in the gay community, but I did feel the struggle that women had when they first began to practice law. I saw that.
Were there any women who were your mentors or who you looked up to in the legal community?
Well, I think Sarah Leverett was the one that we, and there's a book about her too, that we all looked up to. And Jean Toe, she's a you know, mover and shaker, and she's one of these people that she speaks her mind to, and I really admired her. So, yes, those are two women that I just greatly respected. But as far as people, women in the law that I knew on a daily basis, we were mostly in the same boat. So those are the two women I would say that, Vicki Esslinger's wonderful, Melissa Burnett, and of course we were all along the same time, but gosh, there's so many women lawyers out there that I admire right now. Necky Shutt, Melissa Burnett, I think about Vicki Esslinger, you know, all of these people. Ann Furr was a mentor, and she's passed away and some years ago. But, yeah, very kind, very nice. And, pick up the phone and come say, I got this. And a lot of it had to do with gay issues, and they didn't necessarily know either. So we kind of worked it together. You know, they would say, well, this is the way I would approach it. A lot of times it had to do with custody issues with, well, a partner was gay, there was a divorce, and the wife is saying to the husband, you're never going to see this kid again, and that was not true because you can't, that was not. And then I think the judiciary at times were not educated about the LGBT issues and what people face, so that was kind of a challenge. So, I knew women who were working in that area, too. But I was the one that they'd say, go see Harriet.
And so we've talked a lot about oppressed communities, mm-hmm. underrepresented communities.
Yes.
What do you see in the future? I mean, do you feel like we have come a long way? Where are we?
I think it's called a woman's day, a woman's world, a new beginning, and I see great things. Just with these movements that these remarkable women have started in Colombia with the you know, we need to recognize what the women have done. I think there's so many women that are interested now, and I think that there are men that are out there helping them, say, believe in it too. Recognize women, and I just see so much being started and ongoing, not only locally, but nationally, the women who are in politics now that are running for office. I think it's a new day. I have great hope that this is a movement that's been started that will continue. See, I compare it to the LGBT community in a way. For so many years, the LGBT community struggled and struggled and, you know, finally, when their day came, it was like, we're out of the closet, we're not going back. And I think HIV and AIDS had something to do with that because it brought people out of the closet. You had to answer. If your partner was dying of AIDS, you had to do something. And it just happened. And then people would come out to say, I have to help in this. You know, my friends are dying. I just have to take...
Yes.
So it brought a lot of people out that that could be more active in the movement because they were out. I think that's one, horrible as AIDS was, that's one good thing that came out of it. I think it coalesced the gay community into fighting this battle and becoming more organized to fight other battles too, not only AIDS, but just for their rights. You know, because it's been going on for years, but it's been in fits and starts and organizations and because they face so much. If you can't be out to your family, your family, your church doesn't want you. Legally, you're a sodomite and you're a, felony for, sodomy and all this. It was everywhere you turned, it was against you. And why wouldn't you stay in a closet? First of all, you have to feed yourself and put a roof over your head, so you have to have a job. That's the biggest thing. And then the family, so for so long, it was that way. Well, I see the women's movement, I see women building strength through things, and it's just happened. This is a woman's time now. I think this is a woman's day. Yeah. Men just better move over. Yeah. Don't get in our way. But I do see a lot of men supporting women, too, and I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
My grandson was raised, his name's Tommy, he was raised around gay people. Because I'm involved, and he knew a lot of gay people, and he calls himself a feminist. He is a man feminist. He is for women's rights all the way down, and I'm so proud of him for that. So he'll take a woman's, he loves women, and he sees their value and that they're just, sometimes he says he thinks that, I've heard him say, sometimes I think women are smarter than men, And I said, that's just because I've had such an influence on you. I used to tell him I was the smartest woman in the world. And when he was little, he really believed it.
Well, yeah, I think that the newer generation is more open.
They are.
And finding male support for the women's movement.
Yes.
I think is still growing.
It is.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you think is important to add?
I think that one thing that I'm still concerned about, I'm 82 years old, I don't have many more years to go, but I've tried to work on the plight of the transgender. That was a those were the people that didn't come along with the LGBT movement. They were not. They were didn't come under the umbrella of the protection of the LGBT community. Nobody was working so much for their rights. But they are the most maligned, misunderstood group of people that I know of. And although I see people have suffered from the lack of understanding and discriminated against, but this group suffers more than probably any group. Because people do not understand that and they refuse to understand it. And I think that now their day has come to more people are paying attention to that. And I want to see that happen. I want to see there need to be so many changes, so much education in the medical system, the way they're treated, you know, medically, hospitals, ERs, when they go, you know, and how they're treated. And I think that that is my, I call it my last hurrah, is to try to support the LGBT, the trans community as much as I can. And the center, we have a bunch of transgender groups, support groups there, and I'm proud that the center does that. And that's the group that I want to see to really gain their rights and be more understood. So that's, I guess that's my last hurrah.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm interested in now.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome.